Understand. I need more radios. Okay. This is TechNet number 1585. After 33 years of TechNet. Whoops. I flipped the wrong dial here. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and you'll be hearing other people who back up this operation. John KC2 WGB, who maintains the mailbag, watches Echo Link, and also does chat room messaging for people who can't get an edge in WordWise and want to ask us a question. You'll also hear Paul, WS2N, a space expert, and some interesting things have happened with NASA this week, of course. And we just received a new website of a very unusual star from Mike number 2, K1MJM. So maybe we'll renew that tonight. You'll also sometimes hear Hal, K6DPZ, who gives us the result of his lots of experience with electronics. Let me drop. And just like when you watch Bob Hope, Johnny Carson, or anyone else, you think they're funny people. In reality, they've got a good set of writers. People in the back room that really make it happen. And there's a degree of that that also goes on with the TechNet. Eric, KE2EJ, maintains a hell of a lot of equipment to keep this operation going. Let's see, we've also got NY2H, Lou, who maintains some equipment. Bernie, K2YO. Let's see, our president is W2BMP. Our vice president is W2OSR. You can see there's a great big cast of characters to make this thing all work. I think there's a report tonight you're going to make, John, with reference to how people can be streaming the TechNet directly. So why don't you do that right now? KC2WGB, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Good evening. Yeah, we have a quick announcement here from the president, Joe. We now have live streaming on your portable devices. Go and you call up the Limark website. You can access it. Go to the bottom of the page, and it is conveniently located right on the front page, and you can tie in and hear it. I think they're saying it's about a 15-second delay, but that's not bad. So for everybody who's traveling, it's going to be a wonderful thing. They'll be able to keep up to it. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB. And by the way, Mark, FLF has a... has experience with it. If he's still around, he can instruct anybody who's interested. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. Good information. Also, you can always listen to the TechNet with three or four days of delay, and you can go back 10 years of TechNet by going to Mike number 1. Mike number 1, you can get to his website by going to amateurradio.tangovictor. And dial in the right year, the right month, the right week, and each TechNet is in 1 hour reels, and you can listen to those. People will sometimes put them into their portable device and listen to them while they're commuting, while they're on their lunch hour, and so on. Mic number 1 is KC2NJI. Mic number 2 is K1MJM, and you can go to his website, which is limarktechnet.com. You'll see lots of supporting information with reference to TechNet, people's pictures, articles, and so on, Smith charts, and other kinds of data that fits, so to speak. We have a very loose schedule that we almost follow. The first hour, we take questions from people who do have a question or a comment. That's followed by John, who goes to the mailbag for those who don't yet have their proper ham radio license or the right equipment so they can talk to us directly on Sunday night. They have a way of communicating and getting their question across. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, who gives us a space report. And with the time left over, we go into various other subjects of interest to ham radio operators. You don't have to worry about your question that you ask on the TechNet being dumb. There's no such thing as a dumb question. Our philosophy, let me drop. From what I can tell, the general philosophy of that group of people that I just previously mentioned believe that the so-called dumb question is the one that has the greatest gap between what the person knows and what he would like to know. So if you look at it rationally, this question is most deserving of an answer. We don't have that elitist attitude where, hey, that question doesn't come up to our level, and we're not going to answer it. We don't do that. So don't worry about being embarrassed. John, I got a crazy question. I think there is a debate going on tonight. Is that at 8 o'clock or at 9 o'clock? And is that on NBC, the debate with reference to the primaries? KC2WGB, if you got an answer on that, K2RIW.
Yes, there is, Dick. It's the Democratic debate that's going on. The exact time, I don't know. I think it's 9 o'clock, but that'll be Bernie and Hillary there carrying on about their episodes. But nobody in the technical net would be listening to that.
On NBC. So it's on NBC, as I think you said, which is Channel 4 locally. Isn't that true, Eric, our broadcast engineer?
Yes, it is. And John, you can leave your personal comments out of it.
Well, we amateurs, some of us are into politics, some of us are not. Hams come in all kinds of sizes and flavors. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. You need not check in just to say you're listening. After 33 years and after 1,585 TechNets, we believe somebody is listening. There seems to be a track record there that indicates that. So if you've got a question or a comment, give us your call letters right now and your name. A typical sign-in would sound like a WS2N, Paul, and yes. So give me your call letters and name right now. KQRIW.
RJD, Jesse, yes.
Okay, I heard YBB Jesse. It sounded like Yankee Bravo Bravo. Fairly noisy. You started talking before pressing the mic, so I missed all the beginning. So give me your whole call letters a little bit more slowly, Jesse. K2RIW.
KD2IJD, Jesse. Yes, sir.
Okay, your signal is quite noisy. I think you're saying that your call letters are Kilo Delta 2, India Julia Delta. Is that what you said, Jesse?
That's correct.
Okay. I can tell you might be on a handy talkie and walking around because the signal is changing in amplitude. All right, we've got Jesse. Anyone else to check in because they do have a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening. Okay, that was a super noisy signal. Did anybody else hear it besides me? The last person trying to sign in, give us another try. That was a super noisy signal. Maybe I can hear you on the input. Go ahead.
And repeat it twice.
Nissan 375.
Okay, by going to 375, I could hear you, Steve. KD2HUC. Quite noisy. Alrighty, we've got Jesse, we've got Steve. Anyone else with a question or a comment tonight for the TechNet? Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo, Tango, Mike, David, Plain.
I'm going to break in and tell you guys you're not waiting for the beep.
Okay, that was Kilo Delta 2, Bravo, Tango, Mike. You gave me your name, but I didn't write it down fast enough. Please give me your name one more time, sir.
That's David in Plainview.
That David, the one that's in Plainview. Okay, we got you, David. One last call. Anyone with a question or a comment for the TechNet tonight, please give me your call letters and name right now.
That's who I'm with, this space report.
Note for Eric.
Go right ahead.
Eric, the other repeater was out of the conference note. You can take care of that.
Okay, the first person who signed in with a question and or comment was Jesse. Kilo Delta 2, India Juliet Delta. Go right ahead, Jesse.
All right, P2IJD, Jesse here. My question is involving cloverleaf antennas. I've been them for 5.8 gigahertz, and I'm trying to better understand the properties, more like a helical antenna versus a loop antenna, and does that occur when you add more elements, more of a two-planar wheel antenna.
The loop antenna, if I made a small loop, by small I mean rather small with reference to wavelength in circumference, and I properly impedance match it and I properly resonate it by putting a capacitor across the open gap and adjusting that capacitor just right, if the loop is small enough, I will get a very high Q, very narrow band antenna, but it does give you horizontal polarization and omnidirectional. But because it's so small in wavelength of circumference, it's very narrow band. If you built one of those for, let's say, 146 megacycles, I'm reasonably sure that by the time you hit 145 megacycles, 1 meg away, the standing wave ratio would climb very rapidly. It's an extremely high Q antenna. As you make the loop larger in diameter, it starts going down in Q real fast. It becomes a lot more broadband as you make it larger in diameter, as you start approaching half wavelength of circumference. That's the good news. The bad news is no longer omnidirectional. It starts developing a dipole-like pattern. So it favors certain directions and doesn't favor other directions. Let me drop. The clover leaf antenna, which sometimes has three loops or four loops to it, each one of the loops is large enough so that you don't get the super narrow bandwidth characteristic, and because they're offset at either 120 degrees if there's three of them, or they're offset by 90 degrees if there's four of them, you now get a much more uniform pattern. The four loop antennas are literally fed in parallel, in phase. They're all in phase with each other, and that signal that comes out of that cloverleaf antenna has a little bit more gain on the horizon, quite a bit more bandwidth, and reasonably omnidirectional. In other words, there's very little wow to it. Wow is the slight change in signal strength as you go around the 360 degrees in azimuth, if you know what I mean. So a cloverleaf antenna is a pretty crafty design, which sort of solves two problems at the same time without requiring a whole lot of expensive hardware. That's my understanding of the antenna. I only give you an 80% chance that I'm accurate, but that's my way of understanding it, and with a little bit more checking, we'll eventually confirm that, I think, Jesse. KD2, India Juliet Delta. Have you built and are you using cloverleaf? K2RIW, you got it, Jesse.
Yeah, Jesse here. I've made probably a few dozen for transmitting video on our vehicles, and I'm just trying to understand a bit about the placement of the elements, the bottom elements. Well, the fix is about a quarter wavelength on the bottom, then a half wavelength in the radial part, and then a quarter wavelength on the top. And, I was basically experimenting with adding a few more elements to make it like an element equivalent. I don't know if there's a name for that. And I saw it on the receiver. It wouldn't really matter if I mess up the SWR of it.
I think you might be using a handy talkie, Jesse. As you move around, you go from moderately strong to in the noise. So at the end, the last 20 seconds, we completely lost because you moved to a position where nothing came through. Now, the cloverleaf antennas that I have seen quite often have the three loops at the exact same altitude on the mast. The three loops are essentially on top of each other, just barely not touching. From the words you've used, I have the impression that your three loops are displaced along a vertical mast. And so, the theory of operation is the same. You didn't have to displace them, but I think you've got them 120 degrees apart in azimuth, and at various altitudes. Clear that up for us, Jesse. And you said you've built quite a few of them. Sounds like you're reasonably happy with them. And where did you get the design from? Or is it an India Juliet Delta design? KD2, India Juliet Delta. K2RIW in the TechNet.
IJD here. Yeah, sorry, I'm on a handheld. And I just found the design on the internet, as well as a few other designs that I've been looking into making, and I sorted the components from eBay. And you are correct that I'm keeping the 120 degree space seeing the same, and I am seeing the altitude of the elements, you know, and the angle that they would come off of the coaxial cable.
You too, Jack. Hey, Derek.
Two things I want to point out. One, if you look at any typical FM radio station, you'll find things that look like rings. It's not exactly the same operation, but as we stack them, the angle at which the radio waves are launched becomes more narrow, let's say, or more towards the horizon. And I suspect you get the same response. The other thing is that if he's doing this at 5.8, the name of his game is bandwidth, because if you're doing Wi-Fi as opposed to a city transmitting video, and I have a feeling it was MPEG, so that says Wi-Fi. The channelization at 5.8 is quite large, and there's a lot of bandwidth there. So, if anything, the antennas that you're making at those frequencies, you want to be as wide as you can get them, simply because it's being sped spectrum and all over the place. One channel can actually occupy, I think, 20 or 30 megahertz. Wanted to point that out. T2RW, K2J.
Thank you, Eric. Good information. Jesse, roughly what is the diameter of your loops, and what is the vertical spacing top to bottom? KD2IJD, K2RIW.
KD2IJD here. The diameter is about centimeters, and, I got one right here. Sorry about that. Also about 21 millimeters on the height of the antenna.
Very interesting. Have you swept it in frequency? In other words, did you, with some kind of laboratory instrumentation, set it up for a particular frequency at 5.8 gigs, and then go higher and lower to find out how fast it deviates in standing wave ratio? Has there been any bandwidth measurements on your antenna? Jesse, go ahead.
Negative. I don't have any test equipment for that high of a frequency.
And do you know the frequency you're using it at?
Yes, it is 5.8 gigahertz.
There's no more digits than 5.8?
Well, I use it to run on about 8 different frequencies. Starting at 5,740 megahertz, and then incrementing by 20 megahertz up to 5,860.
You're using a wireless modem.
That's good information. Go ahead to Eric.
Ask him if he's using a wireless modem. That's his goal here.
I'm sorry, could you please repeat that question?
Yes, are you using a 5.8 gig wireless modem? A Wi-Fi box.
Oh, thank you. No, I'm using to transmit analog video signal at very poor resolution. Just a few hundred feet for people flying planes and helicopters just to transmit to their base station.
It does sound like you might own a quadcopter, and you might be doing some first-person viewing. I'm making a bunch of guesses. Is any of that close, Jesse? Go ahead.
You know, I'm just going to tell him that he's using the lower part of the band. The band is split up in a couple places, whereas he's actually transmitting analog video, which is 6 megahertz wide. And I think there's 4 specific channels that it's allocated for it.
Yes, they are being used in first-person view quadcopter flying.
Are you one of those lucky guys that owns a DJI Phantom 3? I've seen some videos by some of our club members where they fly these things up to 400 feet high and up to a half a mile away from the house. And boy, they get some beautiful views. Is your machine equal to that stabilization of that particular product? Over to you, Jesse.
Well, actually, with my friends, we are using them for racing, so the quadcopter is maybe around 200 50 millimeters you know, diagonally from motor to motor. Runs at 16 volts and about 50 to 100 amps and probably goes at least 100 miles an hour. Pretty exciting.
If I understand correctly, there's a brand new sport just becoming popular called quadcopter racing, in which you set up a field of obstacles, and it's like a three-dimensional gymkhana. You've got to do precision flying to go in a particular pattern through these obstacles and do it in the least amount of time, and I think some of the copters fly simultaneously. Sounds like an exciting event. I imagine it takes place in a very large park or a bowl field. Is that roughly true, Jesse? KD2IJD, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's correct. And you have up, you know, between 4 and 6 people flying simultaneously. You help with the interference by changing the circular polarization of the antennas from left-handed to right-handed, and trying to vary the frequency with as big a gap as possible.
Fascinating. Boy, there's all kinds of hobbies. Thank you, Jesse. And in the future, come back and let us know how that goes.
I have one more question, dude.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, just out of curiosity's sake, I'm just wondering what resolution the cameras are on the quadcopter. Because if it's standard old video like 525, that's interesting. If it's 1080, then you've got to understand it's not going to be analog. Actually, there's a lot of tricks that they pull in order to get that stuff down. So I was just curious.
And as you answer that question, Jesse, also tell us, are there propeller guards on the propellers so that if the individual quadcopters touch each other, the propellers do not intertwine? Over to you, Jesse, K2RIW.
Foremost, no, there are no guards on the propellers, and they spin at pretty high speeds, so it's kind of a fly-at-your-own-risk scenario. And as far as the resolution of the cameras go, usually they're around 600 dBl in the TV lines, and you know, more 768 by 500 resolution. So you know, nothing close to 1080, just good enough to make it through small arches and the obstacles that have been set up for the course.
You've got it, Eric. Any further comments?
All right, that was an important clue for me. The sensors are actually 720 by 480, and that says we can transmit you analog the traditional way, which means that we buy one chip, which is the transmitter, which fits video in, and we can do the same thing on the receiver side, so it cuts the expense out. If they were going to do, say, 1080, which some of them will do, actually there's some of them out there that's got 4K on them, but that makes it way more expensive because now what they got to do is transmit QAM. Or some folks will actually turn it into a form of MPEG-4, transmit it the traditional Wi-Fi way, where they're also doing the controls to the copter, and you know, that actually comes out to that spectrum, which is less of an issue than what he was describing, that, you know, some people have to use left-hand circular polarization, right-hand circular polarization, or double up on the number of channels that are available to them. Billy says it's analog, whereas the stuff that's coming down digital, the Wi-Fi way, is basically will find that some empty spaces in the said spectrum and not bother each other. K2RIWK,
Jack. One last question I got for you, Jesse. This event where you guys are doing the quadcopter racing through a particular course and you're in competition with other guys, is that taking place somewhere in the vicinity of Malvern, your hometown? Over to you, Jesse.
No, it's not. I believe closest official flying field is in Bethpage at the park, and for racing specific, the closest is in Arlington, New Jersey, and Coram, New York.
Good information. Thank you, Jesse. Boy, and this is quasi-related to ham radio. There was a ham band at 5.8 gigs. 5.7 gigs, as well as 3 gigs, 2 gigs, 1 gig, 10 gigs. I've used the 10 gig band quite a bit in the past, and I want to get back to it. The next person on our list was Steve. Kilo Delta 2 Hotel Uniform Charlie. Go right ahead, Steve. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick.
Hello, everybody.
Dick, are you reading me all right? Because all of a sudden I started getting a lot of static.
Steve, you're getting through the machine with all 80% audio, 20% hiss. Don't worry about it. I'm hearing you gangbusters on the input. So if something you say doesn't come through, I'll repeat it. Go right ahead, Steve.
Okay, very good, Dick. Last week I had asked a question regarding the construction. I'm looking to start constructing my own amplifier. And I posed the question whether or not solid state or tube would be better for a novice like myself, which it seemed like the general consensus was solid state was the way to go. Let me let it drop. So I have two questions. The first one being, I found a bunch of great designs on the internet for both HF and 2 meter amplifiers. My question is, for a novice, which one would you recommend, cutting your teeth on? The multi-band HF or the single band 2 meter? That's question number one. Question number two is, let me let it drop.
By the way, tell us what kind of power levels you'd like to run on those bands. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, the designs I came across were both for 1 kilowatt on both 2 meters and 1 kilowatt on HF. Now, they all seem to have a similar construction with a simple RF deck and then some means of control. All the control boards are regular, discrete TTL logic. And I was looking at maybe doing a microprocessor-based control board. Is there any reason why they would prefer to go with the discretes? I was wondering if maybe RF wouldn't play nice with the microprocessors. Do you have any experience with that? Do you have to go with discrete TTL or are microprocessors suitable for that application? Back to net.
GTZ with the comments. Hal and Eric in that order. Go ahead, Hal.
Yeah, my comment is number one, have you worked at all with high voltages? Are you very familiar with safety procedures? Because when you're talking about kilowatt amplifier with tubes, you're talking about lethal voltages. Kilowatt amplifier with transistors, yeah, you still can get burnt from RF and everything else. As far as control circuits, keep them simple. Don't go TTL, don't go microprocessors. That would be my opinion. I've built many amplifiers and designed many amplifiers. Go ahead.
Hal, you may have missed the fact that he said he's definitely considering CW, solid state, not tube type, and he's now asking the relative merit of T-squared L logic versus microprocessor logic. Let's see what Eric's got to say on that. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Actually, I was going to ask a question, but I will point out that there are a number of really good amplifiers out there that are microprocessor controlled. Something properly designed and caged is, and I have multi-kilowatt transmitters and have multiple microprocessors on them to operate them. But my question to you is, sounds like this is a homebrew project that he's after. Is he looking at amplifiers that are based around a Freescale chip? I can't remember the number. It's an MFRK something. They make one IC, which is really two FETs, capable of a kilowatt from 1 megahertz to the top of that one goes up to, I think, 110. And then there's another one that runs from 30 megahertz and ends at about, at the top of 400. Anyway, these guys run on 50 volts. It's
one big transistor. They cost about $100 a piece. They will tolerate a Vizsla mismatch of over 10 to 1, and they don't get unhappy. And actually, if you go to the Freescale website, when they drop, they even have a PC board pattern that you can copy and use as a basis, and they give you a complete BOM, a bill of materials that it takes to build it. And you will make yourself a 1 kilowatt, 2 meter, 6 meter, 440 amplifier, or make yourself a 1 kilowatt HF amplifier. Their designs do not include any form of alpha filtering, so if you want to be legal, you're going to have to, especially on HF, you're going to have to build a, you know, output harmonic filters for it. Which is pretty simple, pretty easy, depending upon how you want to generate it. If you've got a schematic of something that's ready together, it should have that there. If it doesn't, I recommend caution on putting something like that on the air. But you may have a schematic of something that uses multiple output transistors, which is more complicated. If you're going to build it and you've got a PC board to work with, that's great. If you don't have a PC board to work with, that's not so much fun. But anyway, I turn it back to you, K2RIWK2J.
Yeah, my first comparison of T2L logic versus microprocessor is my gut feel that T2L logic is more tolerant of the amount of RF before it starts misbehaving. But that could be a very minor factor, because if you're smart enough, every single electromagnetic interference, whether it be television interference, cell phone interference, or whether or not your high power amplifier 3 inches away from your microprocessor is creating RF energy into the microprocessor so that it misbehaves. Every electromagnetic compatibility problem is solvable. It's just a matter of using the right kind of shielding, the right kind of bypassing.
It's just as sensitive with TINL as it is with a microprocessor. Actually, you can build smart sense in a microprocessor so that if something actually happens, it fixes itself.
Well, you're talking about a kind of catastrophic failure, Eric. I'm talking about what I personally have experienced, where the logic circuitry picks up RF energy. The RF energy gets rectified by some of the junctions inside of the T2L logic.
I'm talking about the same thing, Dick.
The microprocessor, and the rectified voltage changes biases and changes functions. So for the machine to fix itself in the case of severe RF interference, I'd much rather have a well-shielded box around your microprocessor with well-bypassed leads going into it to stop the problem in the first place. That's my opinion. I'll bet you there's lots of shielding and bypassing on the microprocessors that are on your broadcast transmitters. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
DPZ with another comment.
Actually, I've got both types of control systems and different transmitters. I find that even though some of the stuff is as well designed as it is, if you happen to be working on it, and let's say you've got a cover open, you get a little bit of RF with me in there. And I'm working on something that's old and totally TINL, and it goes nuts sometimes because the RF gets rectified, and what's supposed to be a zero turns out to be a one, or, you know, a low or a high, and it then changes the logic of that whole circuit going on there. The sensitivity of, say, a TTL circuit and a microprocessor circuit having the same thing happen to them, you know, let's say we were doing an experiment and we put 10 watts into an antenna and we pointed it at it and we found that at 5 watts the TTL stuff goes wacky. We'll also find out that the physical layout is similar of the microprocessor version. It'll be about 5 watts where the microprocessor version is going to go nuts too. So whether it's TTL or microprocessor, you still have to make sure that you're not detecting RF by that circuitry. I don't care whose transmitter it is. So, yes, there's a certain amount of shielding to keep things clean. What I was referring to, let me let it drop. Referring to, in terms of fixing itself, was that you get saturation somewhere in a TTL complex logic, which has got NOR gates, AND gates, exclusive OR gates in it, and things are supposed to happen by a certain sequence. Well, when you mess that up, it might not recover because of something further down the line. Whereas that in the microprocessor thing, you can have something called a little watchdog that says, something's wrong. Let's start all over and we'll start from the beginning again. And it goes through its routines. That's what I mean by recoverable. Whereas modern day broadcast transmitter will give 3 tries before it actually shuts itself down. The older versions had an additional level of fail safe because it was designed to do 3 times, but sometimes when you got an RF into something, it never got to 3 times. So they're a little smart. So there's actually an advantage there. KTRW, KTJ.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. In a minute, I'm going to come back to you for the further question. Hal, K16PZ, KTRW, go ahead, Hal.
RIW, I checked that, K16PZ. Well, the gentleman mentioned he wants to build a high-power amplifier. I would say more to concentrate on the RF part of the amplifier than the control circuits. Make the control circuits simple. Don't go into using MOS devices, microprocessors that are subject to RF giving you a problem. Design simple control circuits. Concentrate on building an efficient RF amplifier design, be it VHF or HF. That's where I would start something. If you're getting new into building amplifiers, if you're taking too many loose ends, if you start wanting to go microprocessor and all this stuff, it's not necessary. Analyze what you want to do before you do it. J6DPZ.
Remember, that's an opinion.
Yeah, that's an opinion from a person who's very conservative. I have the impression that Steve is following somebody's well-established design where a lot of those bugs have been ironed out. But the question I've got for you, Eric, is that Freescale, I presume, is the brand name of these super large transistors that are capable of a kilowatt and beyond. In the case of HF, most of the time you want fairly nice single sideband linearity.
These things are so linear, it's unbelievable. They're being made for medical uses, actually, and industrial uses, beyond just the traditional transmission of RF.
So you're telling me that Freescale devices are essentially running Class A, and they're very linear in both the HF and the VHF version? Is that what you're saying, Eric? Fantastic. Over to you, Eric.
Well, I didn't say Class A. I suppose you could run them Class A, but they're running them AB. Or you can run them Class C if you want, you know, if you're doing FM. They're designed to tolerate a lot of abuse, and they're quite linear.
So it sounds like it could be push-ball AB, and therefore, even though it's not Class A, it still has a lot of linearity. It might have 28 dB of third-order intermodular rejection. Is that possible, Eric? Go ahead.
Absolutely. If you go through one of their white papers, they actually have a circuit that uses 4 of them that looks like a bridge. It's used as it's not an MRI, it's not a PET scan because that's X-ray. Anyway, it's one of these devices that generates 4 kilowatts for being used, and it's phase modulated in some form. I forget, it's been a while since I read it.
From what I'm hearing, Steve, you've got a fun project there. A little bit on the pricey side as a homebrew, but as long as you're following somebody's reasonably well-established design, if the design has some history to it, people have built it successfully, then, boy, I would go for it if I were you, and that could be a fun project. Nice, compact amplifier, instant on, lots of power output, and a 50-volt supply is what I think Eric was saying, which means it's going to be a little bit difficult to run it mobile, although there's ways of multiplying the voltage out of an automobile up to the voltage this thing runs. And when you're running VHF, a kilowatt of VHF, very few people would do that in FM service, going through a repeater. FM simplex service, yes. Let me drop. But a kilowatt of FM service through a repeater would make you into an alligator. There's two kinds of people out there, alligator and rabbit.
Well, way too much for satellite.
Yeah, that's also true. An alligator is a setup that's got a hell of a lot of transmit power, or a great big mouth, and no ears by comparison. And some of us run QRP, and we're really rabbits. We got good hearing, but very little voice. So beyond 100 watts, you're moving into the category of being an alligator on a repeater. But if you're using it for sideband service, 2-meter sideband at 144.200, for instance, where you like some nice long range, 200, 300, 400 miles, day in and day out. A kilowatt amplifier with a reasonable Yagi antenna on the chimney of the house, indoor higher, could be a lot of fun. You'll be amazed how many people you'll find out there at ridiculous ranges when you've got that kind of torque power. You'll shake people out of the woods, if you know what I mean. And they'll be talking to you at 2, 3, and 4 times the range that anybody's doing with a repeater. That could be a fun project. I did exactly that on 432. A kilowatt on 432 and 16 Yagis on 100 feet of tower. And I'm talking to people 480 miles sideband, day in and day out. That's 10 times beyond my radio horizon. And I did that for 4 solid years. I just couldn't believe it could be done. KD2, HUC. You're going to enjoy this one, Steve. K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, well, that's comforting. Actually, yes, the schematic that I found, the RF pallet is constructed around that Freescale chip that Eric was describing. I did some research on that chip, and it looks like the designs that I found were pretty much, you know, the skeleton was based upon something right out of the white sheet on it. So, you know, right out of, I think it was Motorola. That said, so I'm pretty confident in the design of that. Let me let it drop. As far as all the accessory circuitry around it, like I said, the control deck, the input attenuator, and so on and so forth, you know, that's pretty much run-of-the-mill. Like I said, I much prefer to do a microprocessor. I'm very familiar with that. That's less experimentation for me than delving into all this TTL and being able to modify it to work the way I want. So that's why I was asking the question. So I think I'm gonna proceed. I'll make the investment. See where it goes. Thanks, guys. KD2 HUC back to net.
I'm gonna ask one more question, Dick.
Yeah, me too. But go ahead, Eric.
Just out of curiosity, is it the kit, or are you interested in developing the control system for it?
I was going to use most likely something simple like a PIC Micro, an 877 or a 77A, something along that line. If I want to add the SWR protection into the circuit, then I'll probably go with the A, and it has a little more in the way of analog in and serial communication. So this way I can do A to D on the front end. But we'll see, you know, it all depends upon how much I want to actually do in the microprocessor.
You've done a lot of those microprocessor-like designs. Tell him where the minefield is and how to do it, Eric. Go ahead. It's 30 seconds. Tell him how to do it.
All right, this is my recommendation. This is an opinion, okay? What I suggest that you do is forget HF for the moment. You can do that later. Do VHF because it's going to be easy. Get the basic board, the input attenuator for it, and if you don't have an output filter for it, it's really easy. You can do it with 3 coils and 4 capacitors. That's the simple part. The basic thing that you could do, which is easy, you could add some SWR protection to it, although if you've actually seen the little video of them actually putting a short on the end of the damn thing and watching it vaporize everything, and the chip is so good, you could go that way. But the simplest thing that you could do is to take a directional coupler and put it in there and take the output of the directional coupler, say 20 or 30 dB down, and rectify that with a nice Schottky diode, stick it into a little op amp and use that as an input to an A to D input on the microprocessor that you're using. And you'll do some experiments at very low levels, or you can use a test generator just to determine what the voltage level that you're interested in having the thing either back off the drive or shut it down. You can have the output of the microprocessor control the power supply voltage going to it. You can also have it control the bias, take a D to A output of the chip. You've got to choose a chip that you're comfortable in
working with and writing programs for it, and have another input connected to a switch which turns the thing on and off, and maybe some indicator lights. If you're interested in measuring the amount of current being drawn, you can put a little shunt in the power supply line and run that into another A to D input. You can use your imagination, but you don't need much more than that to make it run. Let me see if I timed out.
Your DPZ would comment.
No, you didn't time out, so go ahead, Eric, continue.
There we go. Okay, so you can start off simple like that, and as you get a little smarter about it and more interested in it and actually take your voltmeter and make measurements of things as you go along, you may want to tap them off. I don't know what you like to use. I happen to be an old Motorola fan where it's just assembly codes. It's, I don't even need the chart to know what a number means. Or maybe you like the Atmel, or you want to use an Arduino, which pretty much has everything that you need there. It could be a little fun thing. The basic guts being the diagram or the layout that they show you in the data sheet, which is Freescale. Freescale used to be Motorola. Motorola split off the low-end semiconductors, and the diodes went to a division called the OnSemi, one company they made. And the other company that was made is called Freescale. So they're the ones that do all the high-end stuff, the microprocessors and everything else. So let your imagination run wild. Start with the basic block of the amplifier. Get your input attenuator going. Get your power supply going. And then start adding the control circuitry. You don't need it to start off right off the bat, but as you make it more sophisticated as you go along, you can do it simply. If you like making your own PC boards, like I currently am making an amplifier for DMR, which is kind of funky, I actually built my directional couplers onto the PC board, so that way I can measure both forward and reflective power going through it. I use a couple of 5538 op amps, real simple, some nice MACOM Schottky diodes that work up into the gigahertz range, but I don't need to go that high. So there's a lot of interesting ways that you can approach it. Get your IW, I've talked about cages.
Yes, that was a fairly complicated answer. So before we leave that subject, let's follow through on that one. Steve, you might have some fills you need on that one. KD2AQC, K2RIW in the text net.
GPC in the comments.
Dick, are you reading me any better right now?
Reading you beautifully. Stop worrying. You sound good.
Okay, very good. Actually, I feel like Eric must have been, sneaking around my desk, because what he's describing is pretty much what I found. I found a nice SWR circuit based upon a dual-directional coupler. I think it was based upon a surplus NUT. It looked pretty good. In answer to his question, as far as the chips that I'm comfortable, I'm most comfortable with the PIC. I'm fairly proficient at it, so I'm comfortable working with it. Let me let it drop. I am planning on procuring the RF pallet board. Manufactured the Freescale chip. The designs that I came across have it flow soldered right to a heat spreader, so it looks like the implementation is fairly straightforward from an RF perspective. And then I guess, like Eric said, I'll start on the input and work my way through. KD2HUC.
6DP. Comments.
Yeah, it sounds like you're well on your way there, Steve. Go ahead, Hal, K6DPZ, K2RAW.
Okay, Dick. I've built quite a few solid-state amps myself, and what I did, I sampled the drain or collector current. On the devices you're using, you want to sample drain current. Go to the sense of the circuit, measure your drain current. If you have a mismatch or anything that goes sour, drain current will go up, and that should shut it down.
Yeah, that's one approach with bipolar transistors of the older designs. These are Freescale devices. Depending on the phase angle of the short circuit, so to speak, that the amplifier is fed to, in some cases you'll get an increase in current on the drain, Sometimes you get a decrease in current. The sophisticated way to do it is with directional couplers, and Steve is doing it with directional couplers. By my standards, he's doing it right. And if you get a little bit deeper into the theory of operation of a directional coupler, you'd be amazed how simple they are, Steve. In some cases, you just put a little loop of wire with the right orientation close to a strip line on the printed circuit board, and with the right kind of capacitors and resistors set up around that loop of wire, you can make a directional coupler. It doesn't have to have a perfect directivity as if it was a commercial product. I mean, if it has 10 or 15 dB of directivity, which is hard to make them that bad, it would be good enough for your particular service. So I think you're going down the right path there, Steve. KD2HUC for any fills on that. K2RIW in the TechNet.
That's right. Direction.
Go ahead, Hal.
We're not worried if drain current goes low. We're worried about when the drain current goes up and it destroys things. That's my interjection. K6DP3.
Upper ended service, I think it's, you know, a couple hundred dollars. And, you know, all the rest of the components and whatnot, it's going to be an investment. I just want to make sure I'm not going down the wrong road, you know, before I start investing all that money.
No, I like it. Actually, the fun thing about that chip was what Hal was worried about. You don't have to worry about it with that chip. That chip, they guarantee you can put dead shit across it and it's happy as all heck.
And there probably are all kinds of built-in protection circuitries on this free-scale device.
Nah, the junction's taken.
But in the old days, when you have a very high standing wave ratio of a particular phase angle, at some phase angles the drain current goes sky high, or collector current goes sky high, at other phase angles the current goes very low, but the voltage on the drain or collector goes very high, and you can get secondary breakdown in the old days. So just sensing current alone is a little bit too crude to me, but that's an opinion. When it's so easy to make a directional coupler, and you can find out whether or not power is being reflected back into the amplifier, that is, in my opinion, so easy to detect, and Steve is going down that road, I think he's going down the right way. It's going to be a fun project, Steve. It's not going to happen overnight, and bear in mind that all good ideas do not work at first. There's going to be a couple of bugs. Big deal. You've got the resources to buy another transistor if you blow one. I have the impression that these things are so bulletproof, you're not even going to blow one. I think the worst you're going to do is make some hot spots on a printed circuit board and blow out some ferrite transformers or bypassing capacitors, which is nothing.
You know, you can kill it if you don't heat sink it properly.
Agreed, but he's a guy who knows what heat sink means. In the world where he works, heat sinking is very important. Over to you, Steve, for any other comments. You've got a fun project there. We're gonna keep checking with you. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I did see that, Eric, regarding the heat sink. The design, the pallet design that I saw, like I said, the chip isn't even really mounted to the circuit board. The circuit board has two huge cutouts where the chip is placed, and the chip is actually flow soldered to a huge copper heat spreader. So I'll be mimicking some sort of implementation and, you know, down those lines. So the chip is going to be on a huge copper plate. So that's because in numerous places it does say the temperature will kill the device. But thanks for the input, everybody. I really appreciate it. And I'll let you know. Right now I'm still in design, trying to put all these circuits together, and hopefully soon I'll start buying parts. But I appreciate the help. KD2HUC, back to net.
Let me throw one more thing at him.
Go ahead, Adam.
Now, if you're really out of your mind like I am, and you're really wacky, you can do what I would do, is actually liquid cool the damn thing, so you can keep the stage where the RF deck is really tiny. And you can have, if you're into it, two little hoses and a pump and a little heat exchanger. And you don't have to worry about the big, huge metal heat sink and worry about temperatures, because when you run a kilowatt, if you calculate how much current you're drawing, you're making an awful lot of heat. And you can heat your room with it. So I wanted to throw that crazy idea out there for you.
Yeah, fluid is a nice way of cooling things, but it gets a little bit elaborate, a little bit messy. If you can do it with a big enough heat sink and the right kind of airflow, I think it's a slightly simpler design, but that's my opinion. Okay, the next person on the list.
But all my transmitters are water cooled. It's in my mind.
Yeah, but you're, in the old days, weren't you dissipating something like 50 kilowatts of heat, Eric?
In the old days, even more than that. You know, I mean, we're talking about efficiencies that were maybe 30-40%. I mean, today, we're up in the 70s if we're not doing solid state stuff.
Your current channel 21 and channel 13 transmitters in New York City and Plainview, roughly how many kilowatts of heat are they dissipating? Rough number, Eric, go ahead.
It depends upon what's current or what's old. I mean, what's current doesn't throw off anywhere near the amount of heat the old stuff. And as far as like power, I think I know it in BTUs. One transmitter I use right now uses about 95 kilowatts worth of efficiency somewhere in. No, that you're wasting probably 30-35%
Understand. And in order to get linearity, and I think you do need linearity, my guess is you know the transfer characteristics of that amplifying device, and therefore you're using an elaborate kind of pre-distortion in order to force the output to be linear. Is that roughly true, Eric? Go ahead.
John, interesting you should bring that up, because on the analog days, let's put it this way. If I put a sweep in across the channel, let's say I was doing channel 2 between 54 and 6 megahertz higher, I put a sweep into it, I want to see the detected output to be a nice flat line without any kind of bumps and wiggles in it, because that would affect the image that I'd be transmitting. Today, because everything is so digitally oriented, we actually sample the path, and it can have bumps and wiggles and squiggles in it, and we just compensate by what we stuff into it. But let me suggest to you that the channel 13 transmitter is running at 213 megahertz. Each one of those boards that is an output amplifier generates about, well, in the analog domain, it would generate about 1,000 watts. In the digital domain, it's like 200 watts. And they have MRF 151s in pairs. And there's 6 pairs of them. And when you actually test those amplifiers out and sweep them, they're pretty flat. So, you know, you're not making that much compensation. The thing that kills you the most is the time delay characteristics. So, there you go.
So I think you're saying you have to anticipate and compensate for group delay distortion across the 6 megahertz of bandwidth. Is that roughly true, Eric? Including your output very elaborate band pass filter. Go ahead.
That's perfectly spot on. Group delay is a killer for you, especially in the digital domain. So what the exciter will do, it'll sample stuff before the output filter and build a table based on that, and then it'll sample the stuff after the output filter, but if you're really smart, you'll take it right at the bottom of the antenna so you lose the transmission line as part of your sample. And if you're really freaky, you can have a reference antenna somewhere outside that nobody does that. And then what essentially the computer in there does is just calculate the various different phase angles, and it compensates by putting the inverse into the generated output.
There's one slight ambiguity here. When you said the ideal place to sample for the final sampling would be at the base of the antenna. Now, assuming you've got a 250-foot high tower, I don't think you mean sampling into the transmission line at the base of the 250-foot high tower. You'd really like to measure the linearity of the signal, including the transmission line characteristics, right at the antenna itself, right at the antenna's connector. You'd like to do sampling right there if it was possible. Is that roughly true, Eric? K2RIW?
Yes, you would like that, but it isn't a perfect world. Actually, most people just sample it right after the mass filter. So the amount of bubbles that you get when you put your antenna in and you tune the transmission line so that you don't have any bumples, you know, you're assuming that you're not going to do any damage on the way up the piece of pipe.